Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with biographer Nigel Hamilton, author of War and Peace, FDR's Final Odyssey, D-Day to Yalta, 1943 to 1945, the final volume in his trilogy. We'll also hear from New Yorker writer Casey Sepp, whose new book is Furious Hours, Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee. It's a great pleasure to welcome the award-winning biographer Nigel Hamilton back to The Reading Life. Nigel lives in both Boston and New Orleans. He's written biographies of John F. Kennedy, General Bernard Montgomery, President Bill Clinton, and has just completed a three-volume biography of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The second in the trilogy, The Mantle of Command, FDR at War, 1941 to 42, was longlisted for the National Book Award. Today we're talking about the final volume, War and Peace. FDR's Final Odyssey, D-Day to Yalta, 1943 to 45. Nigel, I'm so happy to see you again.
Well, I'm delighted to be here, especially now that the trilogy is finished.
Exactly. So congratulations. What does it feel like to have turned the last page on this series?
A relief and sad.
I'm sure.
I've lived with this man. It's not a biography of his whole life, obviously. It's right. Just as Commander-in-Chief in World War II. And so I've lived with him as Commander-in-Chief from Pearl Harbor to the moment he dies in 1945 for 10 years. So to some extent, I can move on.
I know. Who knows what comes next?
But it's sort of sad to leave him there. I think he is certainly probably the greatest American president of the 20th century.
Well, I have to tell you, it's so funny to me. I had this book on my coffee table, and a friend came over the other day and was looking across the room and said, War and Peace. Haven't you read War and Peace already? And I went, this one is a little different. I mean, but it's massive, War and Peace. This whole undertaking has been really a great endeavor.
Well, I certainly didn't expect to be writing three volumes when I started the project. It just seemed to me strange that no historian had ever tackled FDR in his role as Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces of the United States in what was the most violent war in human history. Nobody had done it. I'd always said that after finishing 10 years on Field Marshal Montgomery, who commanded the American and British and Canadian armies at D-Day, that was it, and I wasn't going to do any more military history. But I just felt that this was a gap in our knowledge, and also in terms of the debt we owe to those people who fought and won World War II, this was a gap that somebody would have to fill. And I felt, well, I am a military historian. I am a biographer. apart from FDR, the biggest personality in the three books is Winston Churchill.
Of course.
And I happen to, as a student, to have stayed with Winston Churchill. I'm the last person outside the Churchill family to have stayed at Chartwell with him and Lady Churchill. And I thought, you know, I'm not intimidated. I want to tell this story for the first time. And I don't know what's in the story, but I'll start it. And I thought it might be one book, but the more I delved, the more research I did, the more incredible the story, and the more surprising how little we really knew how Roosevelt operated as Commander-in-Chief. Partly because he died at only 63.
Well, and you make that point. You know, we often say history is written by the winners, but Churchill went on to write.
And to claim that he won the war. And what a writer. I mean, it's very difficult to compete with somebody who wins the Nobel Prize for literature. But FDR had been intending to write his wartime story. He'd started preparing papers for it And I was able to interview the last surviving member of his map room at the White House, who was beginning to organize his papers. So he had intended to do it. It was just that in April of 45, he couldn't go on and died at Warm Springs.
And isn't that something magical for an historian to have had that? They often talk about the hand that touched the hand. You know what I mean? And so you talk about the person in the map room. You've met Churchill. There is that connection.
True. And I think that is one of the virtues of the biographer rather than just the plain historian, is that the modern biography has been so influenced by journalism. And no journalist would ever think of writing a story without trying at least to interview the people connected with that story. So I was able to interview Roosevelt's granddaughter, officer who ran the map room right from just after Pearl Harbor all the way through the war, and then knowing Winston Churchill and of course Field Marshal Montgomery, who told me a lot about Churchill as a military commander, not as necessarily as a statesman. I felt that even 75 years later, I was able to sort of enter into the drama of that extraordinary wartime experience.
Well, it's so interesting because so much of what you're describing in this book is diplomatic maneuvering, which is as exciting as the actual battles themselves. And there are logistics of setting up negotiations in settings that today might seem so odd to us, like Tehran, Yalta, and just the risk of those undertakings and those meetings.
Well, right. I mean, each volume starts with a voyage.
Yes.
And he is the first president really to go outside the United States in office. You know, in the first volume, he takes a battleship to Newfoundland to meet Churchill, even before Pearl Harbor, to set down the Atlantic Charter, to have some sort of moral basis if the Germans declared war for waging war. At the beginning of the second volume, he flies in a flying boat.
I know, and he was never
to
afraid.
To Casablanca, yes. First president to fly in office and to a foreign country across the Atlantic. And then in this volume, it starts with him taking this battleship, the USS Iowa. And before he goes to meet Churchill, he lands at Iran and he takes a series of plane rides with Dwight Eisenhower, the commander-in-chief of American and Allied forces in the Mediterranean, and spends days with Eisenhower because he wants to quietly interview this young general to see whether he is the right man to command the Allies at D-Day. Again, one of these occasions where, in such a subtle way, in his charming way, he always has an ulterior purpose behind it. And to everybody's astonishment, after he was able to overcome Churchill's objections to D-Day to Tehran, what is the first thing he does? He flies back to Cairo and appoints not General Marshall, the man he himself had said was going to be the supreme commander of D-Day. He decides to appoint General Eisenhower. And what a historic appointment that really was.
One of the great crucial choices of the whole war. Now, one of the sad things that keeps you turning, even though you know what's going to happen, all of this is unfolding against the background of his deteriorating health and the efforts to keep that from the press. And you have these scenes that are so phenomenal about him visiting the troops, standing there and making a long speech, holding on to a podium for dear life. And I don't know that that would be possible now.
Oh, it could never take place today because it couldn't have been concealed. But it is a story of just enormous courage because he returns from Tehran and he's in the best of health, in the pink of good health. Mm-hmm. He gives this broadcast at Christmas 1943 announcing the appointment of General Eisenhower. He's on the top of his game and then he falls ill with flu and he never recovers. And it takes months for his doctor to be forced to actually have him examined by medical consultants. And by then, That's March of 1944, shortly before the D-Day landings were due to take place. It's only then that this young cardiologist looks at the president and says, well, basically, he's only got days to live. He has such a serious heart condition.
You have devoted years of your life to this man. Stephen Ambrose was one of the first historians I ever knew well, and I always remember him talking about walking on the beach at Bay St. Louis and doing his Nixon imitation, and he could still do a really great Nixon imitation all along. And I think all biographers have to be a little in love with their subjects. These people give the writer something back. What has he given back to you?
Oh, a great deal. I think different biographers interpret and focus on different aspects of their subject. I mean, Robert Caro.
Of course.
LBJ. Robert is interested in power. Mm-hmm. Ron Chernow, Hamilton. He's interested in finance. Edmund Morris, who's interested in the scene, the sort of landscape of biography. I've always been interested, perhaps because I grew up in a journalist family, and because when I was so young, I met sort of, you know, fairly distinguished people like Churchill and Montgomery. I'm not a leader myself. I'm just a poor writer. But I am fascinated by leadership. And I think there are so many lessons to be drawn from, in terms of understanding the society we live in and where we're going as a society, studying a great leader, not only the good, but also the bad, the mistakes as well as the victories in the stories of leadership is something that gives me personally a greater sense of confidence about the world we live in. So I emerge, even after a decade, even having put Franklin Roosevelt to sleep, so to speak, I emerge feeling that I've been through a kind of moral journey myself. Uh-huh. And I've emerged at the other side. There is a sense of completeness. Mm-hmm. And when the time comes to go to my grave, I think I feel, more so than if I had chosen to be a novelist, which is what I originally wanted to be, or a poet, you know, I think there is something about the journey, the human journey of biography, which is deeply moving and helpful to the morale and the spirit and the soul of the biographer.
And there's so much in this part of his life about the pursuit of joy, pure joy, and the pursuit of adventure and the lack of fear.
Very brave man. I mean, certainly a standard bearer in terms of those who suffer from paralysis, polio, whatever kind. Mm-hmm. Really quite an extraordinary exemplar in those terms. But as you were saying earlier, just to go on these incredible journeys, I think when he came back from Tehran, he traveled almost 14,000 miles in the middle of World War II.
I know, astonishing
bravery. At one point, when he goes out to Tehran, his ship is torpedoed with a real torpedo.
I know, with a real torpedo.
Unfortunately, it was an American torpedo, which had been fired by accident. But again, it's interesting. He was on deck at the time. There was a rehearsal going on for anti-aircraft fire. And somebody suddenly shouted, you know, torpedo coming. And he demanded of his petty officer valet, Prettyman, he said, you know, move me to the right, starboard side. Move me to the starboard. I want to see it.
I know. I love that scene. This is a book full of thrills and wisdom. It's just, it's a wonderful thing to read.
Well, thank you, Susan.
War and Peace. So, we've been talking with Nigel Hamilton, whose new book is War and Peace, FDR's Final Odyssey, D-Day to Yalta, 1943-45. You can meet him Tuesday, May 7th, when he launches this book at the National World War II Museum Louisiana Memorial Pavilion. Reception at 5, presentation at 6, book signing at 7. And again, Saturday, May 11th at 6 at Octavia Books. Nigel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Casey Sepp has written for The New Yorker, The New York Times, and The New Republic. Today, we're talking about her much-anticipated first book, Furious Hours: Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee. Casey Sepp, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thanks so much for having me. It's an honor to get to talk with you all and to get to talk about my book.
Harper Lee is a writer who is dear to your heart, as she is to so many of us, and a bit of a mystery as a person that you try to unravel in this book.
Yeah, I think mystery is really the operative word. She succeeded in, you know, despite being in some ways a very warm and gregarious person, she succeeded in remaining quite private for much of her adult life. And despite having written one of the most popular novels in American literary history, she was just incredibly mysterious and elusive.
And we all loved her so much that we continued to hope for another book after To Kill a Mockingbird. So you write about an incredible true crime story that Harper Lee set out to cover to make into a book. So would you describe that crime for us and how you came to follow in her footsteps?
Sure. So this is a tremendously interesting case. It starts in 1970 when a rural Baptist minister was accused of killing his first wife for the insurance money. And he was acquitted in that case and, you know, eventually tried a year after the murder. But a year after that, another one of his wives turned up dead, a brother of his turned up dead, a nephew of his turned up dead. And by 1977, a stepdaughter of his had been found murdered, too. And those deaths, one by one, from 1970 to 1977, haunted this little pocket of Alabama over near the Georgia line around Lake Martin and Tallapoosa and Coosa County. And Harper Lee caught wind of them in 1977, when the Reverend was actually gunned down at the funeral of his last alleged victim. And she took a real interest in the case and in the trial of the vigilante, who was actually acquitted for that murder, and found herself in conversation with the lawyer who had represented both the alleged serial killer and the man who murdered him. So she was fascinated by these crimes themselves and by the religious dimensions of them and by the kind of forensic science around them and the way in which they unfolded in these civil and criminal trials, but also in the lawyer who had taken such an active role in both the original cases and in that kind of fantastic defense trial of the vigilante who murdered the Reverend. So she started up with this case in 1977 and came to Alexander City, one of the main towns over by Lake Martin, and moved into a hotel and spent some time in a cabin on the lake doing a tremendous amount of reporting, getting to know a lot of the principals, getting a lot of the documents, transcripts, court files, autopsies, death certificates, just a tremendous amount of activity and reporting, and then spent many years after that trying to turn it into a book, sort of like the one she'd helped Truman Capote write in Cold Blood many years before.
I want you to read a little bit for us from the chapter Horseshoe Bend, which describes a little bit of Harper Lee's life that we may not have seen before.
Sure, I'd be honored to. So this is a chapter I've kind of talked you through the original case, and you've gotten to meet these characters, and we've seen some of her reporting, and now she sits down to do the hard work of writing a book, which is, tragically, writing the book.
Mm-hmm.
So, Horseshoe Bend. Nothing writes itself. Left to its own devices, the world will never transform into words. And no matter how many pages of notes and interviews and documents the reporting trip generates, the one that matters most always starts out blank. In The Journalist and the Murderer, Janet Malcolm called the space between reporting and writing an abyss. It is an awful place and an awfully easy place to get stuck. Everyone told Harper Lee that the story she had found was destined to be a bestseller, but no one could tell her how to write it. When Lee returned to New York from Alabama, it was to 433 East 82nd Street, where she had lived for over a decade. To the extent that a building can resemble a person, Lee's resembled her. Unadorned and inconspicuous, it was in the middle of the city, yet surprisingly removed from its bustle, and from the outside it revealed nothing. Almost no one knew that one of the most celebrated authors in America lived there, hidden in plain sight, with Lee H. listed on the buzzer board. For a while, she shared the first floor with two musicians, known then as Daryl and John, but soon to become famous by their last names, Hall and Oates, who had no idea that their neighbor was a novelist, much less Harper Lee. Others in the building over the years knew who Lee was, but they also knew not to acknowledge her masterpiece. And except to ask about her travels northward or southward, they did not pry into her personal life. On the top floor were the Malcos, with whom she marveled about the superintendent's insistence on smoking while holding his oxygen tank, and speculated about all the other neighborhood characters as well. Below them on the third floor were the Bentleys, Sonia and Frank, whose children adored Lee, including their son, who became her godchild. Below them were Vivian Weaver and Elaine Adams, who had worked for the Council on Foreign Relations and then as editors and typists for Friends, including the writer Patrick Dennis, whose auntie Mame was dedicated to them, Vivi and then A, as they were known, like turning their apartment into a salon and made conversation as easily as cocktails. Lee wasn't a recluse, but she socialized in other people's spaces or met them at museums and restaurants around the city. She was as protective of her interior space as her interior life, and many of her closest friends knew her for decades without ever setting foot inside her apartment. For a woman of her means, the apartment was Spartan, except for the private Bodleian library she had managed to squeeze inside of it. Once, after she'd had a nightmare about being evicted, she made an inventory of all of her possessions for her friends Earl and Sylvia Shores, who lived across the street. Should the dream ever come true, she warned them, the following would be dragged onto the sidewalk: a dilapidated bed, a chair and table, about 3,000 books, and the last two manual typewriters in the world, one of which won't work. In that event, she begged them, rescue the typewriter. The books were her real companions, and she'd been collecting them since childhood. There was the poetry of Blake, Wordsworth, and Thomas Hardy, together with the contemporary American writers she admired, among them Mary McCarthy, John Updike, Peter DeVries, John Cheever, and Flannery O'Connor, plus histories, crime stories, law books, and her favorite five novels, Samuel Butler's Way of All Flesh, Henry Fielding's Tom Jones, Proust's Remembrance of Things Past, Richard Hughes's High Wind in Jamaica, and Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn.
I love knowing what her five favorite books are.
I know. I can't tell you, you know, it's one of those things, you know, she stopped giving many interviews after about 1964, but it's just such a joy to be an archival researcher today because a lot of these small local papers are being digitized. And so, you know, for the first time in a long time, you can really go and find some of these small town papers where they managed to get an interview in that kind of critical window between when she was obliged to do press for her publisher and when she could assert some privacy and refused to do it. So little things like that were sort of lost to history, and now we can piece together a little bit more of her interior life. And of course, I was really lucky. A lot of her close friends shared correspondence, like that letter I'm quoting from there. The Shorises were quite generous. I got to meet with Sylvia, this friend of hers from across the street, and for me, a tremendous reporting day that ended with her saying, you know, here, the stack of 30 letters, go and photocopy them and, you know, make of them what you will. So just truly just some blessed days in the process of trying to learn more about her life.
What a gift.
So what's it like for you to be on the eve of publication of this book? We're speaking before it's actually out. You know it's going to be a bookseller. I mean, you know,
oh,
it's going to be a bestseller.
I have no idea. I'm a real chicken egg kind of person. So from your lips to God's ears.
No, but it's...
I mean, how does it actually feel? It's so interesting. This is a work of nonfiction, so these people are obviously real, and they lived and breathed and had their being outside of my commentary on it. But on the other hand, I've just spent so many years kind of owning them and thinking about them and figuring out who they are and forming my opinions and judgments, and it's just really rewarding. You know, the book is already being read by thoughtful people and smart people and people who are drawing new connections between these characters' lives and forming new theories about their motivations or their modus operandi. And so it's just very exciting because this thing that felt just like my thing is now, you know, something that a lot of people are able to talk about. And I think some of that's really rewarding. It is so interesting to be challenged and kind of have people draw those new conclusions and ask new questions. But it's also, you know, it's a little bit sad. I think I was telling you how much I love to write. There was a little bit of resistance in the final weeks of my book because I just didn't want it to end. And
of course.
I had a relationship that, you know, children have, you know, why they like to read sequel after sequel after sequel, where I was like, I love these characters and I love this world and I've found a way to be at home in it and I can't believe I have to stop. You know, I have to write the final page at some point and hand it over and let the world make of it what they will. And so I think it's all very exciting, and there's just a tiny tinge of sadness that, you know, they're not mine. And, you know, other people will have different ideas and other people will have different things to say about Harper Lee, and maybe they'll think she wrote the whole book of The Reverend, or maybe they think she didn't write any of it. And, you know, I'll be hearing from other folks about their answers to those deep mysteries of who she was and who the Reverend Maxwell was and who Tom Radney was.
Well, it's a rare and wonderful thing to get to think about a book for so long, you know?
Yeah,
it's a rare
true.
Pleasure
I mean,
in
right
life.
Here we are, you know, it's like, if you're lucky, you take a course in college on Ulysses or Moby Dick and you get to spend a semester with it. I just feel like, again, what a tremendous opportunity as a reporter. I carried, I think at this point I probably have 24 copies of Mockingbird. I seem to never have it when I wanted to look at something again. And, you know, I just got to carry it around these hotels around Alabama and California and Georgia and New York and Vermont. And, you know, retracing her geography especially was just, there's always just kind of another opportunity to think about it or to wonder about something else in it. So, yes, what a gift, just a few years with a truly good book.
A talisman for all of us, I have to say.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, for it.
We've been talking with Casey Sepp, who is the author of Furious Hours, Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee. You can meet her Sunday, May 12th at 2 at Garden District Bookshop. Casey, thank you so much.
Thanks so much. It's an honor.
To hear more of my interviews with Nigel Hamilton and Casey Sepp, check out wwno.org. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, Georgia Hunter discusses and signs We Were the Lucky Ones as part of the Jewish Community Center's community-wide Holocaust Memorial Program. Sunday, May 5th at 6:30 at the Uptown Jewish Community Center, 5342 St. Charles Avenue. Diane C. McPhail discusses and signs her novel, The Abolitionist's Daughter. Tuesday, May 7th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. S.A. Lelchuk discusses and signs her novel, Save Me from Dangerous Men. Tuesday, May 7th at 6 at Octavia Books. Local writers Ingrid Green Adams, author of Is There a Doctor in the House? Vivian Collins, author of Why Not a Woman? And Hilda Miller, author of Loving Someone Behind Bars, will discuss their new inspirational books Thursday, May 9th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Lisa Shumate discusses and signs Always and Never, 20 Truths for a Happy Heart, and Always and Never, The Companion Journal, Thursday, May 9th at 7 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. G. Layton Saravalo discusses and signs The Legacy of John McDonough. That's Friday, May 10th at 9:45 a.m. at McDonoughville Cemetery, 520 Hancock Street in Gretna. New Orleans indie bookstores celebrate Independent Bookstore Day all day Saturday, May 11th. Garden District Bookshop, Tubby & Coo's Mid-City Bookshop, Blue Cypress Books, and Octavia Books are celebrating Independent Bookstore Day with special activities. And together, they're offering the chance to win gift certificates to book lovers who visit all four participating bookstores as part of a fun scavenger hunt. Nigel Hamilton discusses and signs War and Peace, FDR's Final Odyssey, D-Day to Yalta, 1943 to 1945, Saturday, May 11th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Casey Sepp discusses and signs Furious Hours, Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee, Sunday, May 12th at 2 at Garden District Bookshop. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.